This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. One of the things that I think that David had wanted to do and that attracted us as curators to David's project was the way that it was trying to raise a discussion. And in the beginning of the video, the part that you might not have heard David explains that he wasn't really trying to create a controversy, he was trying to address one.
Yeah, the controversy is already there.
Yeah. And it's for that reason that tonight, instead of having a crossbar across the street or in the area as we had all planned and worked towards, we documented it clandestinely and just took tonight as an opportunity to show it. Not because we were, as an organization, trying to censor ourselves in the face of media coverage or whatnot, but more because we thought that as a discussion, this format was, you know, the best way to proceed. So that's how I'd say, that's how I'd quickly answer how we ended up tonight not having a live cross burning across the street, which, even though illegal, would have nevertheless been a statement that we would have all liked to have made, and rather, you know, had it here tonight.
Yes, we needed to have probably been elevated above them, but the crosses, there are 12 of them, and they were in the form of a cross. And a cross has 12 facets to it, 12 sides, if you count each area of the cross, it comes out to be, to in fact be 12, a number with which I work. But we needed to have been maybe on a boom or something elevated above it to in fact, get the configuration.
Do you see this this action as one that can be repeated?
Yeah, but not too many times. I don't want to get caught in this crossfire particularly. I mean, there are other things that I'm doing, and I I'm moving on from this. But yeah, I can see it maybe being repeated. And if I get the opportunity to repeat it, one, I don't want to do it ad infinitum, but if I do get the opportunity to make the crosses a little larger.
I understand you have seen cross burnings near your home where you came from.
No. My home, for all intents and purposes, is in Philadelphia, although I was born in Washington, D.C., and as a kid in the late 40s, I lived in, middle to late 40s, I lived in North Carolina. And while there, I never experienced anything of this. Well, one of the things, of course, is that at that time, black parents protected their kids, and so to a great extent, we didn't see very many white people, even though I lived in Charlotte, and there were white people, I mean, the bus drivers and so forth were white. We get to know them because, again, the community was such that that people were relatively friendly. And then we moved into a rural area where our closest neighbors were white, one family. And then just about all the other families around us were black. And then there was a family, I had some cousins who had a store up the road, which in fact it was a rural route. But interestingly enough, there was a kid, and his name also was David, that lived across the field from us and his family. And we played with him and got into a little racial altercation with his cousin. But, you know, after we picked him up and dusted him off, we never had any more trouble with him. But then there was the people who lived further up on the same side. They were white family, they had a kid, and they were more affluent than just about anybody else around there that I knew of. We could go by on the way to our cousin's store. Sometimes we'd stop in and play with the kid, and that was okay. But it was not okay for the white David to play with them, and I guess it's because of class. They were definitely more middle class than any of the rest of us. And David's family was probably poorer than most of the black people who lived in the area. And so the other white family up the road from him on the same side, probably with adjacent properties, they didn't allow him to interact with their child.
Do you
But then sometimes the kids would say, "Oh, the Klan's going to riot tonight," and you know, I never even went home and asked what it meant. You know, it was just something the kids would say. Probably, you know, like the goblins are going to be out tonight. But I never saw any real evidence of it. Although my friend, and she's on her way here, she in fact did see a lynching, or the results of a lynching. And she was from Philadelphia, and they were going south. There was a crowd gathered, and then they pulled over, and of course her family tried to protect her from that, from getting there and seeing it. At that time, the lynching had taken place, and the body was still hanging on the tree. But personally, no, I've never. I mean, I've had things happen to me, but to a great extent, they were more as an adult going to the South on the bus in the early 60s and late 50s. Once I took the bus down to North Carolina to visit with my uncles, and then. Early in the morning, the bus stopped at an eating place. And people got off the bus. So I got off the bus and was going into the place. And then the driver said, "Well, you can't come in here. You have to go around to the side." So I went around to the side. And it was, and this was a regular silver diner. But around the side was a lean-to plywood shack with a dirt floor and so forth. And then... And there were some black people sitting in there, and I walked up to this hole in the side of the thing and ordered a sandwich. And then, so the woman said, "No, what you want?" I said, "I want a sandwich." And then when the sandwich came back, she threw the sandwich at me, and I threw the money at her, and the place cleared out. Then when I got outside, the black gentlemen who were there, I guess, playing cards or something, they took me aside and said, you know, like, "You're just passing through, and we have to live here. So, you know, like, contain your arrogance." And I thanked them and went and got back on the bus.
I have a story similar. I came from Argentina in '62. As an artist, I went to Miami because it's the cheapest flight from Buenos Aires, and I took the bus from Miami to New York. And when we arrived to Jacksonville, I went to the bathroom. You know, the bus stop at that time in places who has counters, and they say, "Beer, sandwich." So I went to the bathroom, I go to the counter, they say, "Give me a beer." So the guy ignored me for two, three times. I get a little pissed off. He was very aggressive. He goes, "What's going on here? I asked you three times for a beer." So the guy didn't know what to tell me. Then he called me and said, "You can't go to the other side." I go to the other side, I didn't even get it after, until I realized that they did not serve me because I wasn't black. And there were two different counters. And that happened to me in 62 in Jacksonville. I will never forget because it was my first experience with this kind of secretion. I mean, I never expected a thing like that. And then we were in New York. I arrived to New York, was different. New York, you know, I was going to every jazz place and with, you know, fun. It was great. But in the South, I have this experience.
I have a question for you. This is a question that you've been asked many times, perhaps, by the media, as to what you are organizing the cross-burning for and what you're trying to affirm. I understand that you're trying to resist the terror and the intimidation that the Klan often presents when it undertakes a cross-burning, but what are you trying to affirm, in a sense?
I must thank all of you for coming out. Well, one, I was trying to inform people of what's going on and that there are a lot of cross burning still happening. And right here in Philadelphia, as a matter of fact. And New York. And all of this is this fall, as we're into this season. But one of the things I was trying to do is to sort of demystify the whole idea of the cross burning, to bring a bit more information to it, and on some level also to inform myself more about it. Because when the incident with Barry Black did and Byron Black did come up, you know, on some level I was relatively shocked, and then I was relatively shocked at the Virginia Supreme Court for overturning the ordinance that they had. And then I usually say that I'm responding as opposed to reacting to this because Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas reacted. And then I'm sure that he voted with the majority to say that kind of cross-burning that they did was general cross-burning was tantamount to free speech. And on some level to in a sense parody but not copy what the Klan is doing, but to do it in an intimate way and with these small non-intimidating crosses.
David, I grew up looking a little different in rural, or not in rural Kansas, but in Kansas. And in the 80s, I grew up around a lot of poor whites. And your story about the other David made me think of the cross-wearing that I saw at a sort of junior school rural keg party. And it was disturbing, and I felt alienated, and the justification was there. I mean, it was play clan. It was baby clan. Tonganoxie, the place, has the largest functioning chapter of the clan in the state, in the Midwest, actually. But these were offspring of, and it wasn't how I understand it's properly done. It was a sort of beer party cross burning. And I just in terms of freedom of expression, do you think much about freedom of expression in conjunction with poor whites specifically? Poor whites is something I found myself thinking about a lot these days.
Well, one of the things, just to focus on that subject, one of the things that we knew of in the South and we knew about and in family legends and so forth was just the people have no idea. We see, I guess, and we hear, and I'm sure I heard on the media this week about Southern poverty. And interestingly enough, when they talk about Southern poverty, they're usually talking about blacks. But the most devastating Southern poverty that I saw was among Southern whites. And this, again, was back in the 40s and so forth. But, and one way or the other, the Southern blacks, with family help or whatever, they seem to have been making it better. Now, I did not go into the Deep South. I mean, I attempted to go in Mississippi summer, in the summer of 63, 64, and my mother would have nothing to do with it. When I let her know, I probably should have kept my mouth shut. But I was going to go during that summer, when, you know, there was a lot of violence. Viola, what was her name, was killed there, and Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman were killed. I don't even think I was going to listen to my mother. What happened was John Lewis, who is now a representative from Georgia, who was then head of SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, he came and asked us not to come. He said, you know, and Stokely Carmichael was a very good friend of mine who became the head of SNCC later, and so was Rap Brown's older brother. We were all at Howard University together. But he asked us not to come and to do something for the people who had been registered to vote and had been thrown off of their farms. And so I gathered with a number of other people, and we just got a lot of materials, food and blankets and crafts items and so forth. And we had never done a radio appeal or anything like that before, but we figured that we'd wind up with a tractor trailer load of stuff, and we actually wound up with three and money, which was, I guess, of some value. I don't guess it's like putting your body on the line.
David, did we ever figure out the connection between or how the cross burnings turned into an act of intimidation? I know we looked up how the Scottish clans, I guess what we'll see, would burn the crosses, I think, prior to war or something like that, or some type of I guess more like action, but I know that those people did find their way to the southern part of the United States or something like that, but how did it, did we ever determine how it actually turned into this, as opposed to just the symbol to let everyone know what was going on, you know, in the neighborhood, in a sense, to something that, you know, or was it an announcement that everyone had lit someone?
I think it was spread abroad by D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation and the cross burning in that film. And then I think that at that point, and many times one of the things that you do find when researching such things is that, you know, no, this was not going on during the time of slavery. This happened pretty much. It got spread abroad during the 20th century. And I think that one of the things that we did find was that film was one of the things that popularized it among the Southern Klan. Thank you.
Well, I was,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
To make a remark.
Oh, okay.
I come from Arkansas. I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, pretty close to where the Klan was supposedly organized. Shortly after the Civil War, by a group of white slavers led by a man named Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a cavalry butcher for the Confederacy. And I've been involved in organizing against the Klan and fighting the Klan in Arkansas and Mississippi and Connecticut and here in Pennsylvania, and there were a couple of things that had to do with your installation that I wanted to comment on. In first, in regard to free speech, I'll tell you a story about a job that I had down in Little Rock, working for an aircraft factory, and we were bench mechanics. We made small parts for the aircrafts, and we were instructed not to talk with each other, so that our production would be higher. And if we were caught, we'd be disciplined. Of course, we talked. So we talked. I mean, that's understood.
Yeah.
But the issue is that free speech does not truly exist. It exists here in this room, but we're going to see to it that it exists here, right? But free speech is a function of class domination. The ruling classes around the world want to see to it that that their capital is appreciates at the correct rate, which means that the workers have to work at the correct rate and keep their mouths shut. I was fired from this job because I insisted on talking to my coworkers and so on and so on. I'm just trying to say that I applaud your emphasis on free speech. I think we've got to recognize that we've got a long way to go before we truly have free speech. The other thing has to do with violence. Obviously, these are violent, terroristic, depraved, madness-oriented symbols, and the people are, throughout my life, I've run in over and over again into people who are very confused about this matter, this subject of violence, particularly as I grew up in the Christian church on the cross, and we're taught somehow mysteriously to turn the other cheek, which is not what was meant by the scripture at all, in my opinion. My notion is that we have to face violence. We have to be courageous enough to face violence with violence. We have to be willing, like John Brown in Kansas, as you were mentioning, and in Harper's Ferry, and in other places. Great, great leader who is vastly underappreciated, a hero here in this country. But people consider him a fanatic and a crazy man. But attacked slavery in the way that it had to be attacked.
and partly responsible for precipitating the Civil War, which allowed the people in slavery to free themselves. That's what we're about to. Anyway, blah blah. But the point is, my point is that we have to be willing to fight. When the Klan comes out, when the neo-Nazis come out, like they did up here at Valley Forge back in September, we have to be willing to go up there en masse and say, you are not to organize here. You have no right to be here. Free speech for racism doesn't exist. And drive it out. We need to drive. Fascism is growing by leaps and bounds here in the United States and all around the world. You read it in the papers every day about how this group and that group and the other group in Europe and here want to get rid of the immigrants, right? Well, who isn't an immigrant? So we've got to be willing to fight these people on their terms. And we need to organize and be ready to make war against them. We need a revolution against these people and against the fascists of all kinds. And working class people are extremely powerful, but we just are not aware of it yet. And
Russ, let's see if somebody wants to respond. Do you want to respond?
David?
Speak for yourself.
Yes.
Okay.
I would like to say something. Well, you see, I'm not American. You can see by the way I talk. And the truth is that it's very difficult for somebody who is not American and come from abroad and it's not many years here to understand the dynamics of the so-called democracy here. And the people here doesn't rebel. I mean, I'm Argentinian. People doesn't rebel, but not at the level of racism who's supposed to be done 100 years ago. But you see, at the level of artists, if I want to turn the scene to something much more pacific and less revolutionary, how is it possible that people will pay $20 to go to the Museum of Modern Art? How is it possible that education is so expensive that you have to you know, send your children, and if you can, to... So there are so many things who come together with the idea, I mean, all the art market, the idea of how things are... The revolution implies much more things, that the racism is one of the consequences of the revolution. Because what they brought here for slavery, they brought it for economic reasons. And so, in the meantime, the economic reasons still like they are today, it's not going to be any change. Because people have such a mental addiction to television and to bullshit in the mind that they believe that you're a terrorist, or I'm a terrorist, or somebody's a terrorist, even if you say something who seems logical for any human being. So the vision of the Americans vis-a-vis what happened is very, very blurry, no? You can say blurry. It's very blurry. So I think there are things that are inconceivable, and they look like democracy here. But democracy begins that everybody can send children to school, everybody can go to an hospital, everybody can take a test and not pay $600. I mean, this is part of the problem. The problem is much more bigger and includes the racism and includes the delusion about, you know, you can make it. Nobody make it here. That's what people drink so much. So all these things should be contextualized altogether, in my opinion. I'm with you. I'm not against what you say. But I think that the problem is much bigger. And each one has to fight in any sense he can, from every point of view, from every place he teach or does something to change the things. But the main enemy is the system. It's a system which, by the way, is all over the world now. What do you think the Europeans are doing with the galleries and with the... They're copying the system of education, the system of health, everything is like in America now. And this is something who should be seen as in a big context, and how to have a solution should be part of all people to try to have opinions and fight. But because it's true, but this is a consequence of economic things. The fact of exploitations, if you go to Brazil, if you go to Argentina, if you go to Chile, if you go to Peru, the president of Peru run away, don't come back, stay in Japan with all the money. But this, and he's not expulsed from the United Nations, you know, I mean, things that happen every day, people who die in Africa every day with AIDS because they let people die, because they want people to die, they don't need it anymore. So the problem is big, big problem. This is, I mean, I'm not trying to reduce the problem of the black people, ever. It's a big problem. And the problem is to change the world, not to change only here. Because...
Yeah, I'll just say a few words to follow up on what Osvaldo said. We started this as an, you know, as a gallery doing an art project. We were interested in David's art because it looked paradoxical to see a blind artist who was doing interesting things. And that's how we called it first, retinal, non-retinal. But then, at least if I can just speak of myself, and that's what's probably the logic of the project, I discovered that I was blind, or that I didn't know enough, and I didn't know about all this. Like Osvaldo had the experience of going to the South and being totally shocked, being French, by what remains of discrimination and segregation and so on. But we are here, supposedly, in a very liberal and free country at a time when we know many liberties are threatened more and more in the name of terrorism and what else. So I think it's important to see that an artist like David is doing more than art or political art and helping us see things that, well, we know vaguely about, but maybe, as you said, not actively enough, and that we have to be ready to fight a little more. At least for that, I thank David for having brought home to me my own blindness and made me think about these issues.
You talk for everybody, for myself too.
Well, I for one would like to thank David and tell him how much I appreciate his courage and his perseverance and his artistic ability, and I think that I'll give him an arrow.
And by the way, out of all the social consideration, I found this show, artistically, snobbishly speaking, fantastic, okay? I will put this show in the Whitney without any bad conscience, because I believe it has together the conditions which are required for real good art, which is having a very strong ideological content, an interesting original form, and not economic value, which is one of the things which destroy the art in the world. And David works absolutely to find the three things that I think are very important those days to show the world in the art world. So it's not only that I thank you for doing a great show socially, but I really like the show aesthetically, I mean, from the artist's point of view. I think it's a great show. Thank you.